This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ben Platt, stars in the new film adaptation of the hit Broadway musical Dear Evan Hansen. He originated the role in workshop productions of the show and then won a Tony for his performance as Evan Hansen in the original Broadway production. He started his film career in the movie Pitch Perfect as Benji, the nerdy kid who desperately wants to join a school a cappella group. In the 2019 Netflix comedy series, The Politician, Platt starred as a high school kid who plots every move in his life to achieve his ambition of becoming President of the United States. He now stars in an episode of the new anthology series, The Premise, and he has a new album called Reverie. In Dear Evan Hansen, Platt plays a high school senior who has terrible social anxiety. He has a hard time talking to people. He's fidgety and hunched over, but longs to be seen and to have friends. He's on antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds, and his psychiatrist has given him the exercise of writing encouraging letters to himself. The movie opens with him writing one of those letters.
Dear Evan Hansen, today is going to be an amazing day, and here's why. Because today, all you have to do is just be yourself. But also confident. That's important. And interesting. Easy to talk to. Approachable. But mostly just be yourself. You know, that's number one, obviously. Be yourself. But like a confident version of yourself. Like approachable and interesting and not weird or anxious or depressed. But you're not weird or anxious or depressed. I don't even know why you're bringing it up. You can't be scared to talk to other people. You said that you'd be better. You said this year would be different. You're overthinking it. Do you like having no friends? All you have to do is just be yourself.
I've learned to slam on the brake before I even turn the key, before I make the mistake, before I lead with the worst of me. Give them no reason to stare. No slipping up if you slip away. So I got nothing to share. No, I got nothing to say. Step out of the sun if you keep getting burned. Step out of the sun because you've learned, because you've learned. On the outside, always looking in, will I ever be more than I've always been? Cause I'm tapping on the glass. I'm waving through a window. I try to speak, but nobody can hear. So I wait around for an answer to appear while I'm watching people pass. I'm waving through a window.
In one of the letters Evan Hansen writes to himself, he confesses his fear that no one will ever notice him. He wishes things could be different and that he could be different. The letter is intercepted by another student, Connor, who refuses to give it back. Connor is infamous for being a weird, angry loner and has bullied Evan before. Soon after, Connor dies by suicide. Connor's parents find the Dear Evan Hansen letter in Connor's pocket and assume it was written by Connor to Evan, confessing Connor's own insecurities. The parents meet with Evan to learn more about their son from Evan, who they think knew Connor best. Evan wants to tell them the truth, but they don't let him interrupt their incorrect interpretation. So Evan goes along with it and reluctantly keeps getting deeper and deeper into the lie. Ben Platt, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm so happy I got to see the movie because I didn't get to see the show. And I really enjoyed the film. So thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of the show. I'm very pleased to be here.
So many young people deeply identified with Evan Hansen and his anxieties, his loneliness, his feelings of being shut out and not good enough. But when you were playing Evan Hansen on Broadway, as more and more people were identifying with the character, your life was changing and making you not only seen, but famous, a star on Broadway. And you're getting interviewed and performing on TV. You got a Tony. And I'd imagine that in some ways you were getting further and further away from the character as more and more fans were confusing the character with you. Because I'm sure it was a boost to your confidence to have the show go so well and to be so applauded for it in reviews and awards and all that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think although on some level and in some regard, I did feel closer and closer to him in the sense that I, as I've already mentioned, of course, in any interview within the first 5 minutes, I'm a very anxious person. And so I think that the growing notoriety that you mentioned and the kind of larger magnifying glass that the show brought to me and to the performance definitely added to that anxiety and that pressure. And I think that that's something that Evan certainly operates with. And so I think that element of it made me feel a bit closer to him. And additionally, the experience, while it was, you know, incredibly gratifying and fulfilling, was very isolating as well, and kind of a lonely one because of just the nature of the role and how kind of monkish my lifestyle needed to be to support the role. And especially when we were doing, as you mentioned, press during the day and performances on television and things like that, it required that any, you know, moment that I had to myself was spent, you know, resting and recharging and saving up physical, mental, and emotional energy to continue to recreate the show 8 times a week. And so in my own mind, I certainly continued to feel connected more and more to Evan in terms of the anxiety and the worry about, you know, others and what others might think and what others might be saying. And, you know, those things come along with the territory of something that gets that kind of attention.
So was your anxiety similar to his? I mean, do you have stage anxiety?
No, I think that's, for me, the place that I am the least anxious. That's the place where my mind is the most quiet. I think that's part of the reason that since I was very, very young, I've wanted to do this. I think it's like a really special kind of reprieve to me, because when you're, I mean, any kind of performance on film as well, but particularly for live performance on stage, it just requires that your whole being be incredibly present. And I think a lot of my anxiety comes from the inability to be present and feeling stuck in worries about the past or what's to come rather than being where I am. And so being on stage for me is kind of the antidote to that, because there's no option but to be present where you are. So I would say that's my least anxious spot. I'm much more afraid of, you know, social situations or, you know, flying, traveling. There's other things or triggers more so than the Evan's stage fright.
So I want to play another song from the movie adaptation of Dear Evan Hansen. And just to set it up, Connor dies by suicide. And when he was alive, everyone thought of him as a crazy, combustible kid, someone to avoid. He had no friends. His sister thought he never even noticed her, and she found him threatening. His parents hardly knew him because he was so remote. And when he dies, there's a memorial for him in the high school, because he's become a lot more popular in death than he was in life. And the student organizing it tries to recruit your character, Evan Hansen, because she believes you and Connor were best friends. And you know, Evan doesn't want to do it because he knows it's a lie, but he caves in. And when it's his turn to speak, he's shaking at the mic. His voice is barely audible or comprehensible. He knocks over the mic. It falls to the ground. He falls too. He gets up. And then he sings a song about Connor. And remember, he didn't really know Connor very well. He knew him from two brief, uncomfortable incidents. And so what he's singing about is really more about his own anxieties, which he's projecting on to Connor. So this song is called You Will Be Found.
Have you ever felt like nobody was there? Have you ever felt forgotten in the middle of nowhere? Have you ever felt like you could disappear? Like you could fall and no one would hear? Well, let that lonely feeling wash away. Maybe there's a reason to believe you'll be okay. 'Cause when you don't feel strong enough to stand, you can reach out your hand. And oh, someone will come running, and I know they'll take you home. Even when the dark comes crashing through, when you need a friend to carry you, And when you're broken on the ground, you will be found. So let the sun come streaming in, 'cause you'll reach up and you'll rise again. Lift your head and look around, you will be found.
That's Ben Platt from the new movie adaptation of Dear Evan Hansen. Taken out of context, that song sounds so inspirational, and that's how it's interpreted by all the students at the memorial. And videos of you at the memorial go viral. But the song is really both the truth, because it's Evan Hansen's truth, but it's a lie because A, it's not about Connor, but B, Evan Hansen is never found. He has no hope that he will really be found. and I like that tension between seemingly inspirational but actually far from it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what's fascinating about the piece in general, and that's why it sometimes is somewhat polarizing, because it does require that level of discomfort and that gray area and that kind of nuance of things being healing and redemptive and meaningful, but also morally ambiguous and difficult and wrong and predicated on a lie. And I think as much as he is singing about, you know, all these things that he's finally found and this belonging that he finally has, I think he's also on some level singing about how, you know, that at some point or another, everyone will be found out and everyone's truth will be revealed. And that is, you know, that includes him.
You started performing when you were like 6 years old. I think your first role was The Prince in Cinderella. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Yeah. I went to this youth program called the Adderley School for the Performing Arts that all three of my older siblings had done before me. And as soon as I was old enough to join the youngest class, my parents put me in, and Cinderella was the first role, and I was bit quite forcibly and immediately by the bug.
So, did you have any clue then that you were gay?
I think, did you ever see Fun Home? That wonderful
Alison
Bechdel.
That.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So the song Ring of Keys in the show is all about like this experience of identifying with queer people before you're even old enough for it to be sort of a sexualized discovery. And I do really identify with that. I think I was around, you know, queer people by virtue of being in the theater, and, you know, I knew a lot of gay men, and I think before I had any, you know, a sense of, you know, any kind of attraction or sexuality or anything like that, I think I just identified on a more human level with them, and I think I felt like I saw myself in them, and that seemed like the kind of person that I might become. And then, of course, once I was through puberty and old enough to understand, or at least in the midst of puberty, understand what that really meant, that's when I was like, oh, of course, that's what this is.
Were you at age 6 feeling any kind of disconnect between being like the heterosexual prince who awakens? Oh no, wait, it's Cinderella, not Sleeping Beauty, right?
Yes, just chases after her and puts, not that, I mean, not that much disconnect, because he does try shoes on a bunch of women, and I was wearing a sequin sort of a sparkly vest that I loved wearing. So no, I think I was just thrilled to be in a cute outfit and singing songs.
It strikes me that, like, well, Broadway, but also like the theater community in high school, you know, like the theater kids, that would be two of the most comfortable places to be if you're gay, because like so many people on Broadway are gay. Like if Broadway was homophobic, that would be kind of ridiculous. I mean, I'm sure some people are, but really, that's got to be a relatively comfortable place. And maybe ditto in, you know, among theater kids in high school. Did those seem like comfortable places?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in terms of the scale of the gay experience, I had a huge amount of privilege in the sense that I was in a liberal bubble and my parents were very accepting, and I had known and worked with gay people my whole life, and I had other gay people in my school. And as you said, my theater program was very open about those things, and, you know, certainly felt accepted and did not face the kind of adversity that so many young queer people have to face that is truly just revolting that it's still happening. But I think regardless of that, you know, any queer experience, which I think is also, you know, shifting in the right direction, which is very encouraging. But I think any sort of young queer experience, there will be aspects of society or, you know, institutions or things that are in place that just don't feel made for you, or that don't feel, you know, that they've been created with you in mind. You know, for me, what comes to mind is, you know, summer camp, which I loved going to summer camp, and I love my Jewish summer camp. And I know that, you know, even in the recent years, they've done more work to kind of service, you know, queer kids and kids that are you know, non-binary or trans youth. But I think, you know, going to something that is so binary like that, where, you know, you're spending so much time
with, you know, all your male counterparts, and so much, you know, emphasis is put on the separation, you know, while you're a young person who's queer, connecting pretty much only with, you know, girls. All my friends were girls. And so the, you know, the inability to, you know, be part of that community and to feel like sort of an outlier in the sort of male side of things, I think was my kind of version of that outsider experience of being a queer person. But again, I couldn't have been luckier in terms of the hand that I was dealt in that regard. And to your question, yes, theater, more so than any industry, I think, has always been not only welcoming to queer people, but essentially, you know, built and run by queer people. And they're like the lifeblood of the whole thing.
You mentioned Jewish summer camp. Is that where you were Sky Masterson in a Hebrew version, a Hebrew language version of Guys and Dolls?
That is, yes, that's correct. When you're in the oldest age group, you're allowed to be in the musical finally. And of course, it was Guys and Dolls my year. So I was Sky Masterson in Hebrew.
Could you possibly sing a few bars of maybe Luck Be a Lady in Hebrew?
Yes, I can.
Oh, good.
Hey, lady, t'nili mazal. Hey, lady, t'nili mazal. Im atzo cheret odech lady mitnaheged rock, t'nili lady mazal.
That's great. I have to ask you about a project that you're doing now with Richard Linklater, the film director who, among other things, did Boyhood. And in Boyhood, it was shot over a period of years, and we watch all the actors actually get older as their characters get older, because real time has elapsed. It's the same amount of time has elapsed in real life as it does in the film when we watch the boy grow up. And now you're doing that with Merrily We Roll Along, which is a wonderful Stephen Sondheim musical that closed really quickly when it was first produced on Broadway. And now it has like a real following. It's been revived a bunch. And so Linklater is making a film adaptation. And this is a show that takes place over, I don't know, about 18 or 20 years. And it starts in the present, and then it goes back in time as the scenes progress. So we start with the characters kind of in middle age, and then it goes all the way back to when they the day they're graduating from high school, with all these idealistic ideas of what the future will be. It seems like such a gamble, starting a project that's going to film over 18 years. It's such a long commitment. I mean, what better thing to commit to than a Stephen Sondheim musical? But it's such an act of faith.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a passion project with a capital P. It's, I think, the idea, the conceit is just such a uniquely effective idea. So many of us love Merrily We Roll Along, and there have been a lot of great productions that have done so many beautiful things with it. But I think there's always that one level of disconnect of having to watch the same actors play the course of 18 or 20 years and wanting to really feel the pain of what that fallout was, and to see people go from their most jaded to their most naive is such a moving thing, even when you're sort of playing at it on stage. So the idea of really watching in real time, you know, actors de-age and go back to their most sort of fresh-faced, naive selves. As you said, it's a leap of faith. It's going one sequence at a time. The idea is to shoot, you know, one every couple years, and we're trying to do the first at the end of this year. As daunting as it is to board something that's theoretically going to be for 18 years, and as unrealistic as that feels and sounds, I think it's too exciting and special of an opportunity not to at least try. And I think we'll take it one sequence at a time, and God willing, one day it'll come together. And if it doesn't, we'll have at least spent these, you know, few years making something special. And I certainly hope it does.
It's such a long commitment. So you'll be in your like mid or late 40s by the time the shooting wraps up. Is it forcing you to think about who will I be then? What will my life be?
I think about that anyway, because as I said, I spend a lot of time worrying about what's to come and what has happened already, and not as much as I should being where I am. So yes, I think it's made me think about, will this be the one kind of holdover at that stage in my life that I'm still doing? Or will I still be working all the time? Or will I be, you know, God willing, still singing my own music and maybe just doing that, and this is what I pop into? Or, you know, will I be on stage for the rest of my life, which would be wonderful too? You know, will I hopefully, God willing, be with Noah, and will we have children? And I think I'd love to hopefully, theoretically, be at some point a bit more of a behind the scenes kind of a person. I'd love to continue to write and to hopefully maybe direct theater someday, and, you know, get to do things that are creative, maybe even teach, you know, musical theater to young people, just to stay connected to the art and to the thing that makes me the happiest, even past the point of maybe feeling up to doing it myself. But for now, I'm grateful to be doing it myself.
Ben Platt, it's just been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Ben Platt stars in the new film adaptation of the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical, Dear Evan Hansen.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair.
By the end of the 1960s, the Beach Boys had come to a crossroads. Their early, lightweight surf music hits were behind them, and Brian Wilson's more ambitious compositions were being met with a lukewarm commercial response. Then in 1970 and 71, they released the albums Sunflower and Surf's Up, back to back, two albums that rock critic Ken Tucker says represent the Beach Boys at the peak of their artistry. A new 5-disc reissue of these two albums, called Feel Flows, is filled with 135 tracks, including 108 previously unreleased tracks. Here's Ken's review.
This new release covers my favorite period of the Beach Boys, a time when the group had moved beyond its surf music pop hits, when Brian Wilson, an undeniable genius, the center of Beach Boy gravity, but also its most unstable force, was still active enough to be trying for mainstream success. But 1970's Sunflower was also a time when the Beach Boys truly became a band. Each member, brothers Brian, Carl, and Dennis Wilson, Mike Love, Al Jardine, and Bruce Johnston, was called upon to contribute more than he ever had, not just the gorgeous harmonies, but also lyrics, riffs, and concepts that could further their goal of being both popular and respected.
I'm thinking about this whole world.
Every member produced at least one track on Sunflower, making it unique in the group's history. The result was the best music ever made, for example, by drummer Dennis Wilson, whose It's About Time is a remarkable comment on creative frustration and breakthrough, taken at a harder pace than the Beach Boys had ever attempted.
I used to be a famous artist, proud as I could be.
The track was written by Dennis, but its lead vocal was from brother Carl, and by all accounts, it was Carl who was the glue holding things together during this period. Carl, who died in 1998, played lead guitar and led the band on stage, and was often the group's most impassioned voice.
So hard to answer futures, riddle when ahead is seeming so far behind. So hard to laugh a childlike giggle when tears start to torture my mind. So hard to shed the life of before, to let my soul automatically soar. But I hit hard at the battle that's confronting me, and knock down all the roadblocks that's stumbling me, throw off all the shackles that are binding me down.
So this 5-disc collection, Feel Flows, is one of those big, unwieldy box sets that I usually avoid reviewing because I'm rarely sure they're worth the price tag. I'm still not sure, to be honest, but I certainly appreciate the presence of an obscurity like I Just Got My Pay, a sketch of a song that eventually mutated into the awful single Marcella. Why is this version better? Because the rhythm is tighter and because Mike Love gives you the exact figures of the narrator's income.
5 long days and I'm tired of working.
the train, 'cause I just got my pay.
Now I could take and sock away my dough and make me 6% a year, but it's not much fun.
The Beach Boys' next album, Surf's Up, was built around its title track, a 4 minutes-plus opus whose stately pace announced a new self-seriousness. Its cryptic lyrics written by Van Dyke Parks made sure you would not mistake it for just another surf and safari. The pretensions of the Surf's Up album matched the mood of the record-buying public in 1971. Surf's Up sold much better than Sunflower and was more widely praised. Overpraised. You can hear Mike Love introduce Surf's Up in this 1973 concert version, telling the crowd that the then-famous classical music conductor Leonard Bernstein had praised the song. It's a naked plea for admiration, at a time when pop art still looked to high art for cultural validation.
In case anybody's interested, this song was written by Brian Wilson and his friend Van Dyke Parks, and Brian played it once on a TV show, on a Leonard Bernstein special, and Leonard Bernstein said that it was one of the best songs ever to come out of rock music. So Cousin Carl here is going to sing the song that Brian and Van Dyke wrote called Surf's Up.
A diamond necklace played the part, hand in hand some drum to loud war, to a handsome man in the town. A blind class aristocracy, back through the opera glass you see the pit and the Benjamin Brown. My God, my God, collinated Rubens diamond. Canvas the town and brush the backdrop.
Where Sunflower was still reaching out to its audience, the Surf's Up album documented a process of withdrawal from the center of pop music. Brian Wilson, in particular, struggling with his mental and physical health, would remove himself not just from the fans, but from his brothers and bandmates as well. After these two albums, the narrative of the Beach Boys twists and distorts and shatters. Mike Love becomes the leader of what is essentially an oldies act, and the studio recordings vary wildly in quality. Looking back now, this was the last time the Beach Boys were men united in a common goal of capturing the sound of pure pleasure.
Turn up the click track. I can hear it.
Here it goes.
They're not too.
Ken Tucker reviewed the new Beach Boys collection called Feel Flows. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Anita Hill. October 11th will mark the 30th anniversary of her testimony at the Senate Judiciary Committee's confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. Before a committee of all white men, Anita Hill testified about how Thomas had sexually harassed her when he was chair of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and she worked there as an advisor to him. Her testimony was unlike anything heard before at a Supreme Court nominee hearing. Here's Hill answering questions from Joe Biden, who was then the chair of the Judiciary Committee, and was asking her to lay out her allegations.
What was that incident again?
The incident with regard to the Coke can that's spelled out in my statement.
Once again for me, please.
The incident involved his going to his desk, getting up from a work table, going to his desk, looking at this can and saying, "Who put pubic hair on my Coke?"
Was anyone else in his office at the time?
No.
Was the door closed?
I don't recall.
Are there any other incidences that occurred in his office with just in his office, period?
I recall at least one instance in his office at the EEOC where he discussed some pornographic material, or he brought up the substance or the content of pornographic material.
And again, it's difficult, but for the record, what substance did he bring up in this instance in his at EEOC in his office? What was the content of what he said?
Well, this was a reference to an individual who had a very large penis, and he used the name that he had been referred to in the pornographic material.
Do you recall what it was?
Yes, I do. The name that was referred to was Long Dong Silver.
The way Hill was treated made a lot of people think that it was Anita Hill who was being put on trial. She was accused of fabrication and erotomania. She received death threats. But her testimony was a wake-up call. As New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer, who co-authored a book about the hearings, said on our show, many of us had experienced sexual harassment but didn't really know the name for it or how to handle it or that there was a way around it. By making her case and speaking so straightforwardly about it, Anita Hill educated the country. Now Anita Hill has a new book called Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. Drawing on some of her own experiences, legal cases, and stories shared with her by victims of sexual harassment and assault, she writes about what's changed and what still needs to be changed. She's a professor of social policy, law, and women's and gender studies at Brandeis University and an activist working against gender-based violence. Anita Hill, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back on the show. It's been almost exactly 30 years since the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. You were a very private person at the time that you testified. You were not used to speaking in public. How have you changed since then, and how has your purpose in life changed since then?
Well, the closest thing that I had to speaking in public 30 years ago was speaking in front of a classroom. And frankly, speaking in front of a classroom actually helped me in my testimony and has helped me evolve to what I hope is a better public speaker than I was 30 years before. It's very, very hard to sum up all the ways that my life has changed since 1991. I've changed my career. I've changed my location. I've actually changed my focus of work outside of teaching from sexual harassment in the workplace alone, employment discrimination. And I shouldn't say I've changed it, I've expanded it to include other forms of gender violence.
You went into law because of the civil rights movement. Do you feel that in its own uninvited way, that the Clarence Thomas hearings led you to find your purpose in life and your purpose within the civil rights movement?
I'd say yes. The hearings really moved me in that direction in a way that I hadn't expected, though, because at the time of the hearing, I was teaching primarily commercial law and contracts. I did some teaching in the area of sex discrimination as covered by the civil rights laws, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but that was not my primary teaching focus, and it wasn't even my primary research focus. However, I think it was the hearing and the combination of hearing from victims and survivors about their experiences that pushed me to look more deeply at how the law was, in many ways, failing them.
Is there anything you would like to see done to challenge Clarence Thomas's presentation of himself at the confirmation hearings? How troubled are you that he is now the longest-serving Supreme Court justice?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because my goal in this book is to talk about the process of the Senate Judiciary Committee, how we are vetting judges to get onto the court. And I think that's the bigger question. My concern is about the systemic problems that exist in protecting people who commit gender violence or misconduct. And so what I really want to focus on is, where is the process that we need to be in place that will fully vet judges and Supreme Court justice nominees from actually getting on the court in the first place? And that lies within the Senate. We have a process right now, as evidenced in 1991 and in 2018, that really is non-existent, I should say. I'm not even sure we can call it a process. Neither Christine Blasey Ford nor I knew where to go with our complaint. A process, an effective process, would have clear guidelines about where an individual should go if they have information about a nominee that didn't exist in 1991, and it doesn't exist now, as far as I know. And if I don't know about it, I don't know how anybody would know about it who had that kind of information.
Yes. What kind of process would you like to see? Have you thought about that?
Oh, well, first of all, you need to have clearly understood and public and transparent a complaint filing process. How do you report this? Who do you report it to? What's going to happen with the information once it's reported? All of those things need to be in a complaint process. A second really important element is an investigation, a thorough investigation that goes beyond the testimony or the statements of each individual, the person bringing the complaint and the person that they're accusing of misconduct.
Yeah, so you can't just say, well, it's he said versus she said, so
absolutely.
Let's just vote him in. I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have now. And finally, you have to have a clear understanding of what the consequences are when evidence is thoroughly weighed and there is conclusion that there is some reasonable belief that the complaints are truthful. And so we don't have any of that now. And therefore, we really are at risk of what happening in 1991 and what happening in 2018 happening all over again.
Do you think women who come forward need to have some kind of protection? You got all kinds of threats. And Christine Blasey Ford had to actually move and basically go into hiding because the threats became so bad. What kind of protection would you like to see for women who come forward?
Well, you know, this is when I talked before about a process, just a basic complaint process, that's just the beginning. Because I think what people don't understand is that there is a before, during the hearing, and an after the hearing problem. And what I think people assumed in my case, and perhaps in Christine Blasey Ford's case too, was that we just went home and everything was back to normal. And nothing could be further from the truth for each of us. What we need and what was really lacking was that the senators held this hearing, which put us really at risk of public blowback, but then offered nothing in terms of resources or guidance or statements to the effect that when we stepped forward, we were doing something that was our right to do and was in fact our civic duty to do, to bring evidence to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you experienced after you testified? what kind of threats that you had, hostility that you faced?
I faced death threats. When a threat to myself and my home is a threat to my family members. I remember one episode in particular where I was at home in the evening of Friday evening, and I got a call from the dean of the law school saying that there was a bomb threat on my home. It just happened that that was a weekend where my mother, who was 80 years old, and my sister and her three young children were visiting me. And we had to make a decision about evacuating the home, whether the threat was so clear that I needed to evacuate. You know, there were other vulgarities that came through in the mail, terrible, nasty materials. And I'm talking about physical excrement, human excrement, I suppose. I don't know exactly what it was, but it came through the mail. I mean, so those threats that happened in 1991 were mostly in the mail. There were threats on the telephone. But I suppose today what happens is with all of the social media and the different platforms for threatening folks, that the threats are actually even more vivid and more pervasive today for witnesses coming forward.
Did you have to, like, harden yourself, toughen your exterior in order to survive the kind of threats and hostility that you faced? You also faced a lot of love, a lot of outpouring of support, and a lot of people who wanted to tell you about their stories, people who wanted your help or your reassurance or, you know, your legal help, all kinds of things. But what about facing the hostility and the threats? What did you have to do emotionally and psychologically to live through that?
Well, one of the things that I've learned very early on since 1991 is that I am not alone. There was that sense of isolation during the time of the hearing that existed. But afterwards, hearing from others who had faced similar circumstances, maybe not as public, but privately faced those circumstances when they tried to complain. Hearing from them, just realizing that I was not alone in facing this kind of scrutiny and actual hostility, was affirming. But I also, internally, I also knew that what I had done was the right thing to do. Because I had important information about an individual who was picked to sit for a lifetime appointment on our country's highest court. And that was my duty to do. But it was not just a professional duty as a lawyer, but I believed it was my ethical responsibility to come forward in the best way and the most effective way that I could. And that's what I did.
Did you feel at all like you'd failed because he was confirmed in spite of your testimony?
You know, and that's the message that I want survivors today to get. Because people will tell them that if your accuser is not prosecuted, or if they don't lose their job, then you have failed in coming forward. I believe there is victory in being able to come forward and state what has happened to you if you have been abused. That is the start, really, of a conversation and a process that may not end in exactly the way that you think it should be ending in. But 30 years later, I'm here to say that even though Clarence Thomas was confirmed, I do believe that what I did was effective, because it opened a conversation publicly in a way that had never been done before. And I've heard from people whose lives have been changed because that conversation was open.
That is so true. There are two justices on the court now who have been accused, one of sexual harassment, one of sexual assault. Has that affected your faith in the Supreme Court?
Well, my faith in courts is still strong. Courts have an important role. I still think that the court, though, is weakened when individuals on the court are weak. And that's why I think it's so important for us to get these processes right, so that we can, in fact, get the best, most credible people on the court. At the very least, we can do that.
Anita Hill, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Anita Hill's new book is called Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberto Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.